Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein in studio in Fargo with my co-host Ashley Thornburg.
Hello. Happy April, is it?
No,
it's already April.
Fooling, Ashley. Yeah. It's April Fool's Day today. Have you ever been a victim of an April Fool's prank,
oh,
Ashley?
Oh, my coworker, my former coworker Jacqueline, got me real good one year when I was just sick to death of mailing things out to people. I had opened all these packages, I had cataloged them, I had sent them out individually, and all March she had been keeping boxes. And on April Fool's Day, she had all of these empty boxes delivered to my office. Just when I thought I couldn't handle sending one more package to someone. It was very well done.
We were victims once that I remember as parents. My wife was working at our business. We owned an athletic club and the phone rang. And my daughter's sixth grade teacher called and said, Mrs. Blumenschein, your daughter was just caught racing away from school on the football field. She was going to skip school. Do you want to talk to her? And my wife says, absolutely.
Oh, I had to start strangling her through the phone.
Daughter comes on the phone. I can't believe that. And immediately our daughter says, Mom, you're on speaker. You're in front of the whole class. This is an
no
April
swearing.
Fool's joke.
Oh, dear. Oh, that's a good one.
That's a good family one that we always remember at this time of year, Ashley. Well, we've got a busy show today, Ashley. Later on, a serious topic, the story of Craig Rowe, a former standout football player at the University of Michigan, who passed away at just 33 years old after an 18-month battle with stage 4 colon cancer. And in an excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast, we'll talk about the alarming increase of colon cancer in young people. That's the topic. But we'll also have some more fun with April Fool's Day.
But first, stories connect us, and film is one of the most powerful forms of storytelling. The Dakota Film Festival is happening April 4th and 5th at the Bell Nehus Auditorium in Bismarck. It explores who we are and our place in the world. And in a few minutes, we'll hear from Indigenous filmmaker Prairie Rose Seminole about her film, We Ride for Her, a film honoring relatives and raising awareness about how murder is the third leading cause of death for Indigenous women. The film premiered at South by Southwest, and it is showing on Thursday at the Dakota Film Festival. We hear now from Mary VanSickle, one of the festival organizers. Mary, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. We always appreciate an opportunity to talk with you.
Roughly how excited are you for April 4th and 5th?
No, it's getting a little hectic around here for sure, but, you know, everything's going pretty well. So we're good and we're excited, yes.
Well, tell us about what is most exciting to you about the Dakota Film Festival. Quite a range of short films showing on Thursday and Friday.
Short films have always been kind of our focus, and two full nights of films this year. Thursday has a focus of more human interest stories. We've got a few documentaries, couple of pieces of animation, and a panel of scholars that'll talk with the filmmakers who are present that evening about their film. So that's really looking forward to that, as well as Friday night, which is more of our typical kind of anything goes night. It's fun because there's just such a variety of genres that we show, and it's everything from a little bit of horror to a documentary to some animation and some narratives and certainly some comedy mixed into all of this.
And in a couple minutes, we will hear from one of the filmmakers with a featured film on Thursday who will also be speaking at a panel discussion and happens to be a local filmmaker. But you get films from kind of all over the place. How do you decide what films you want to show to have that sort of worldwide presence, but also that regionality? You know, you have Dakota right in the name of your festival.
You're right. It's a balancing act with our film selection committee to take a look at how can they kind of incorporate not only Oscar nominated films and sometimes Oscar winners alongside of a local film. And it's always surprised us, but it shouldn't. They stand up to that kind of standard, should we say, and it is exciting. We are so proud that We Ride for Her was submitted to our festival, coming off their premiere at South by Southwest. So we are very excited that film has been submitted, and that will screen on Thursday night.
And that film explores the movement to raise awareness around a very important topic, missing and murdered Indigenous relatives. Talk about that balancing act there when you have really important films, but then also there is room in the human condition for levity, for comedy.
Oh, for sure. Everybody loves that. And I think that's what we've seen over the years is that people who come are surprised by the variety that they see, and it moves from one thing to another. And I think that's a bit of a luxury with short films, because you might not be enjoying a particular film for a while, but you understand that it's probably only a few more minutes and it's going to change to something else. So it's a bit of a roller coaster. And I think that's part of the charm of the Dakota Film Festival. We understand, you know, you just came off Fargo Film Festival, which is very prestigious as well, but they have feature length, they have shorts, they have animation and a lot of variety as well, but they span over a number of days. We have a bit of a luxury in that fact that we only have the two nights with 14 films in total. So we can be very, very selective on what gets chosen to be screened.
You started on this, but why short films?
I think it was primarily because we can get more in one night, right? You know, if you have a feature-length
it's
film,
practical.
you're going to have one up, possibly two, that can go back, a kind of a double-header type thing. But originally, our event started 12 years ago as a day-long event that we had workshops for students during the day. We no longer do that anymore, but we kind of kept with just the evening screenings. So that's why we keep with the short films.
Mary Van Sickle, Executive Director of Dakota Media Access and one of the organizers of the upcoming Dakota Film Festival. It's April 4th and 5th at the Belnehus in Bismarck, and you can get tickets. You can find out more at dakotafilmfestival.org. Mary, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ashley. I appreciate it.
And joining us now is one of the directors of one of the films showing at the Dakota Film Festival, again happening April 4th and 5th in Bismarck at the Belnehus Auditorium. Prairie Rose Seminole directed the film We Ride for Her, which explores the missing and murdered Indigenous women movement. There is a group of women motorcycle riding across the country to raise awareness for this very important topic. Prairie Rose Nawa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Tell us about the process of making this film, because this is definitely one of those films that takes a lot of coordination. You're riding, meeting up with women as they are on motorcycles traveling across the country.
Honestly, this was an incredible journey to take with these women. Once we found the Medicine Riders, the story kind of blossomed from there, because one of the real intentions setting forward with this project was to not exploit trauma and to be moving from a trauma-informed practice of filmmaking, because documentary filmmaking can be very much invasive, in your face, and the practice is not so much caretaking about community, but getting a story to extract and to move forward with. And so as filmmakers, we were very intentional about, one, not wanting to exploit the trauma, but also to really look at how we implement trauma-informed practices in filmmaking, as well as develop a community shared model of ownership of this film, because as an Indigenous filmmaker, we have a history of people not only exploiting our story, but then owning our story once it's done. We didn't want to do that. I'm very grateful to have an executive producer who was totally on board with, yes, how do we give this back to the women? How do we give this back to the community stakeholders? How do we share this story? Because it's not one that belongs to one person or one community. It's one that affects so many of us. And so this process, which we thought was going to be like, oh, it'll be done in a year, 3-year project, because we hired trauma-informed specialists. We hired Native counselors and victim specialists to really allow us to help curate that that plan to put it into practice. Yeah. And so we had a way of interviewing our women who share their story with us and the families who share their stories with us in a way that they felt comfortable sharing with us. And really, that's kind of the speed of trust, right? Mm. We built relationships and we built trust in how we interviewed. And then we had 8 days to film our film. And
wow.
We had a plan in place that we used time efficiently. We had community care practices in place, like just one that allowed us to fully give ourselves into this process, but also get this incredible story to tell. And as a first-time filmmaker, to be able to take pause and to guide the team, our production team, our producing team, in a way that allowed us to take that space to build trauma-informed practices, mm-hmm. to implement trauma-informed practices, to even ask those questions. Like, this is not a first-time filmmaker's experience at all. Like, and I know that because I've been involved with, like, the Fargo Film Festival for 7 years, curating Native Voices, been a part of different creative projects that have produced films. But this is the first-time opportunity to be a filmmaker that allowed me to help share the story that affects my family, too. And when they first approached me, that's really what it was about, was to not only co-direct, but to tell my story. And I wasn't ready to do that. This filmmaking practice, telling this story with We Ride For Her of the Medicinal Riders and Heather Taken Alive and her sister, this has allowed me to move my grief into advocacy and action as well, and to be able to speak to my own grief and how this issue has affected my family in a way that doesn't shut me down anymore. So it's been a healing process. These women embraced me. These women embraced me just as much as a survivor of violence and someone who's been touched by the loss of a missing or murdered relative. They made me an honorary rider. Like, I'm probably the only one that doesn't have a motorcycle, right? Like, but they made me a vest and gave me the patches and put me on a bike. It's just incredible how loving these women are and showing up for individuals wherever they really put that ego aside to say, this is an issue that affected me and we need to show up for each other. And I hope that's what other advocates do as well, because this is a world where people like to exploit trauma and make money off of our people. Yeah.
You've used the phrase trauma-informed a couple times in that first answer. What does that mean?
Missing and murdered Indigenous relatives is an issue that affects so many communities. And when you see films or documentaries or newscasts about this particular issue, it very much exploits the trauma. And so you're causing harm to communities that it's affected, to even audiences who've never heard of the issue watching the film are so traumatized that they feel helpless or hopeless, or wow, that's, I'm so glad that doesn't affect me. I can go back to my daily life, right? Mm-hmm. So this disassociation happens, right? So trauma-informed practices was one that moved forward in a way that knew that we didn't want to cause harm with the telling of the story, but also with bringing awareness to this issue. We wanted elements in there that talk to trauma, because we can't talk about trauma without speaking to trauma.
Right, particularly on a topic where it's, you know, women go missing at 10 times the national average, and Indigenous women, murder is a third leading cause of death, and regularly at the hands of white people, and they run into this incredible, perfect storm of jurisdiction issues.
Yep. I mean, law enforcement is inundated with new cases of missing and murdered Indigenous relatives like weekly, which causes them to kind of prematurely close them with no resolve. So what kind of justice or what kind of comfort are we getting in that justice system when, you know, our Indigenous women are more likely to experience violence in their life than actually graduate from college, right? Like, that's the statistic that we shouldn't be accepting. And so to answer that other question, though, that trauma-informed piece, we really wanted to make sure that this was done so in a way that allowed people to understand the issue, but also not to get that disassociation or that shutdown, which could happen in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So. Well, and I think in a lot of ways, a hopeful film.
I was hoping people walk away with that because here's this group of incredible badass motorcyclists, right, who each could have their own like narrative feature in their own right because of their life stories. They're just incredible women. But here they are, like, all affected by loss and grief and traumatic grief. Like, the stories that each of these individual women have, just, how do you get up in the morning when you've experienced so much violence, right? Like, but here they are, not just showing up for one individual in this film, but time and time again, they're rallying around families who experience violence. They're rallying around those who need advocates, and they're really caretaking in the best way that they can. And sometimes that's showing up, sometimes that's giving money, sometimes that's standing next to the families as they identify the remains of their loved ones, and sometimes it's escorting the remains back home. I mean, and so many things beyond that, but here they are moving their grief into advocacy and action. And how we wanted people to walk away from this film was understanding, like, you can play a role in this, whether it's just asking the question, like, how does this happen? Like, why is this acceptable? It's not, right? But starting as an audience member, just even ask the question, I want people to walk away at least asking how they can help and show up.
We're visiting today with Prairie Rose Seminole. She is the director of the film We Ride for Her, which is showing Thursday, April 4th at the Dakota Film Festival. The Dakota Film Festival happening in Bismarck at the Belle Mayhouse Auditorium, April 4th and 5th. Prairie Rose, an Indigenous filmmaker of the Arikara, Sanish, and Northern Cheyenne people groups specifically. Let's talk a little bit more about the responsibility of the viewer of this. And a lot of times in films like this, you know, I'm thinking back to when you said, put the story back in the hands of Indigenous storytellers and filmmakers. There is the flip side of this is that doing the work of understanding this needs to fall onto the dominant society. There needs, I don't know if it's an onus exactly, but of understanding our role in this, realizing that you cannot control how people watch a film, how do you hope that people who didn't grow up with an Indigenous lived experience do the work that is really necessary to understand a film like We Ride for Her?
Yeah, I think our film is actually coming at a good time, especially following in the wave of Indigenous representation happening in the media, like Killers of the Flower Moon. That is another film that sheds a light on the United States history of genocide and systemic oppression of Indigenous people, and the continued dark reality of violence and consistent devaluing of Indigenous women. Like, Indigenous women and girls in the United States are more likely to experience violence than non-Indigenous girls, right? So we know these statistics. But here's this film, like We Ride for Her, doing a touch on the reality of missing more Indigenous women and girls, which is a horrific one, right? With the origins in violence brought upon Indigenous communities by colonizers, by non-Native individuals, and the dominant culture has put that into our institutions and our systems, right? So combined with a justice system that was never established to protect Indigenous people, created this epidemic that we see today. I mean, this film just touches on one story, when we could have touched on so many. But there's over 5,500 missing and murdered Indigenous relatives right now, and that number is really conservative. And so when you're asking what non-Natives can do or what audience members can do once they see a short film like ours, because our film is only 18 minutes long, but yeah. I hope that it instills in them that they can also take matters into their own hands to see what kind of an impact they can have. Understanding, you know, that Native people are one of the most legislated demographics in the country, right? Even though we have our sovereignty and our inherent rights to autonomy, we are still very much legislated because treaties are at that federal level. So who we vote for matters. The jurisdictional barriers that we address in the film with law enforcement, having our law enforcement talk to each other, right? Like, it was that easy to have the film talks to the Rapid City Police Department, which is a non-Native jurisdiction, to talking with Oglala Sioux Tribe, their jurisdiction, right? Just having them talk to each other. They're funded by the same Department of Justice that law enforcement agencies are funded across the country. Why cannot have those mechanisms in place that allow them to have the ability to work with each other more easily, right? So barriers like that, advocates outside can just start asking those questions and then creating that public pressure for authorities to do the right thing.
Are you seeing a change in that direction?
Oh, gosh. I think with the movement overall, I mean, I'd love to see our film, like, do this thing where it's educating mass people across the country, but I don't know if that'll happen, right? This is just one small thing to do within my reach. But I think within the movement of those working within the field of missing and murdered Indigenous relatives, we are starting to see that. We're starting to see more representation. We're starting to see more jurisdictions look at the cases more closely. I mean, the pressure that was created in Montana, for example, after national news started highlighting what's happening in Montana, like asking that question, like, what's happening here? Why are Native women and girls missing and being murdered and found, and then their cases going cold, right? Like, why is this happening? And so there's more pressure happening across the country, I think, for jurisdictions to not only work together, but just, you know, start communicating and putting plans in place. North Dakota, a couple legislative sessions started to ask, can we put together a missing and murdered Indigenous relatives database? And when they started looking further into it, the legislation passed, but in a way that says, we don't have legislation to even look at missing people. So that's what we have now, is a missing persons database. But the follow-up to that is that it's unfunded, right? So if we're going to create legislation that's meaningful, we're also going to have to fund it and house it in a place that sees it with that measure of accountability that our people matter. Sure. And it's not just Native people. It's happening, you know, to a lot of communities as well.
So it's an election year. What do you hope voters will keep in mind relative to these kinds of issues?
We will not find comfort in a justice system that is tied to stolen land, broken treaties, forced removal of Indigenous people, and countless government policies centered around assimilation and cultural genocide, right? So when you think about how elections matter, do we care about these issues that people unlike ourselves are facing, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm very passionate about these issues, but are my non-Native relatives passionate about these issues? Some are, but some are not, because they can disassociate, right? So if we're going to create systems that work for all of us, we need to really hold ourselves accountable to ask questions, raise consciousness, and demand action for the issues that matter, you know, whether it's Indigenous people, whether it's incarcerated individuals, whether it's individuals who are the minority of demographic within our state and country. Like, we have to ask those questions of, like, how can we improve lives? Our lives are already good, right? But how can we improve lives within the system that matter? And so I just hope voters are informed and not divided around the politics that have become divisive in this country, but just really look to make this place a safe place for all of us.
We're visiting today with Prairie Rose Seminole. She is the director of We Ride For Her. There is a Q&A following the showing of your film. Why is a Q&A important at a film festival?
I think it's important to have those Q&A sessions after a film, because it's going to bring up some pieces that folks want to unpack. I think it's a space to talk with the filmmakers about different intentions around the film itself and themes that have been coming up within the film. And also, I think, for filmmakers to help people unpack what they just viewed in a film, because this is going to be a new issue for folks. And to have sat through even a short film like ours, experiencing a new issue that's brought to their attention, it's going to be a time for a filmmaker to kind of help guide through not only unpacking that issue, but also put that onus. Now that you've seen this, you're responsible. Like, you have the privilege to be responsible and accountable to your fellow neighbors, whether you know them or not, but there's this piece happening and it matters. Like, we have to pay attention to it. So how do we show up and how do we address these as a community? So it's going to move that raising awareness to, I hope, building community and allies.
Prairie Rose Seminole, the director of We Ride For Her, showing at the upcoming Dakota Film Festival in Bismarck. And you can find out more about the film at WeRideForHer.com or the film festival at DakotaFilmFestival.org. Prairie Rose, Wetaxkoye? Did I get that correct? Wetaxkoye?
Way to go shade.
Way
almost.
To go shade. Wow, I was not
way
close.
To go shade.
Way to go shade. Thank you.
No, it's the way our language is spelled versus how it's said is very different. But yeah, it's like, way to go shade.
Way to go shade. Way to go shade, Prairie Rose.
Thank you. Thank you.
Still to come on Main Street, a look at colorectal cancer. That's after this.
Debate season is here. And Prairie Public will host a pretty big one for this part of the world. It's the Republican primary contest for governor of North Dakota. I'm Dave Thompson. Join me and the candidates, Congressman Kelly Armstrong and Lieutenant Governor Tammy Miller, Tuesday, April 23rd at 7 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Mountain. You can listen on a radio, a smart speaker or app, watch Prairie Public television service, or stream online at prairiepublic.org. Prairie Public's Election 2024 coverage is made possible in part by AARP North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg with my co-host, Craig Blumenschein.
Ashley, we have now a Conversations on Healthcare excerpt. Co-host Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner introduced Dr. Alan Vanuk from the University of California, San Francisco. He's one of the nation's leading colorectal cancer researchers, and the interview begins with the symptoms we should all be aware of this disease that should not be ignored.
Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, Dr. Vanuk, take just a moment to share with our listeners, what are the presenting signs and symptoms of colon cancer versus rectal cancer, risk factors, and we'll talk about screening a little bit further on.
Sure. So the general sense of these of colon and rectal cancer is a change in bowel habits. And most commonly, let's say bleeding, finding blood in the stools would be the most disconcerting and most likely to signal that there's a colon or rectal cancer, although most rectal bleeding is not associated with colon or rectal cancer, but it certainly should raise your index of suspicion. Family history is very important. If you had one first-degree relative, you're at greater risk. If you've had two first-degree relatives, you're at very high risk for colon or rectal cancer. And again, the symptoms are often dismissed by patients. So either because they want to ignore them or they just don't think it's a big deal.
Right.
So bowel, you know, intermittent diarrhea and constipation, some crampy pain, for example. As I said, bleeding being one of the most common things that's noticed. The problems we're having now is the distribution of patients who are getting colon and rectal cancer has changed. In the last decade, there's been a stunning increase in incidence in young people. And so it turns out that young people are less likely to go to the doctor for anything, let alone for rectal bleeding. Mm-hmm. And even when they go to the doctors tend to dismiss it as, well, it's not cancer, so hemorrhoids or whatever. And so we're seeing, unfortunately, young people who, even those who've reported earlier symptoms, tend to be more advanced by the time we recognize the cancer. So this is it's a sort of a changing paradigm in terms of who we have to think about and our index of suspicion mm-hmm. for who's going to get colon or rectal cancer.
The American Cancer Society and the U.S. Preventative Service Task Force, which we sort of think about as the gold standard, recommend that colorectal cancer screening begin at age 45 for asymptomatic average population. But the American College of Physicians says the screening should start at 50. I think this is conflicting guidance to the public, and some of your fellow physicians say it does a disservice to have such confusion. What advice do you have?
Well, I agree it does do a disservice. The challenge, and I think the American Cancer Society's change from 50 to 45 a couple of years ago was based on modeling, where they recognize that there's a greater incidence in younger patients who are developing colon and rectal cancer. And they sort of thought about how many people this included and what was realistically achievable. I'm not sure that 45 or 50 is the right time. As I said, we're seeing a lot of patients in the age range of 35 to 40, and you're not going to find cancer early if you don't screen until 45. I think we're missing the boat a little bit on this approach of colonoscopy to screen or even fecal occult blood. I think what we have to do is determine if there aren't some circulating factors that tell us who's at greater risk for having colon or rectal cancer, sort of enrich the population for patients likelier to have the disease, and then try to screen that population. I must say, in our approach to screening people over the age of 50, we've been quite successful in really markedly decreasing the risk of colon and rectal cancer in patients over the age of 50, even if the penetration of that screening is maybe only 60% of patients get the proper approach and are checked for the risk for the possibility of colon rectal cancer. that's enough of an intervention to decrease the incidence quite markedly in patients above that age. So we could do do the same with younger people, except you just can't be doing colonoscopies on all the young people that are around.
Well, maybe just speak to the value of doing the at-home tests that we now have available. Certainly they've improved over the many years that I've been in practice. What can we do to get more people to engage in doing a screening test at home at whatever age level we set as the appropriate one for screening in the absence of family history?
Penetrating the population of patients and people telling them, getting them to believe that they should do this is very difficult. It's always stunning to me how hard that is, let alone trying to change their diet or doing other things that might have a bearing on this. I think it's incumbent on primary care physicians to actually emphasize this and push this. And my disappointment is that many primary care physicians don't really see this as a focal point. But I don't know. I don't know how to convince people that these sort of unpleasant things, let's say is taking a sample of stool and putting it on a card, exactly why that's so unpleasant, I don't know. But it's very hard to convince people to do that. The tests are not perfect, but certainly they would help to identify some patients who could avoid bad disease and early death because of a cancer.
You know, I want to pull the thread on your comment about diet and what's the impact between a vegetarian diet and other diets in terms of contracting colorectal cancer?
Well, certainly so-called Western diet, which is like, let's say, burgers and fries, that's not good. That it clearly increases the incidence of colon and rectal cancer. In contrast, a non-Western diet, fruits, veggies, those people who have those diets have less incidence. But it's not absolute. One of the things I'd say is, for example, the change in the young patients getting colon rectal cancer, these are not people necessarily with different diets. They're vegans, there are triathletes, there are all sorts of, there are people who would, you think, not have the standard risk factors for cancer who are getting cancer at a young age. But with everything else, smoking, for example, is a risk factor for colon cancer. You know, high fatty foods, red meat, those are all things to avoid. But patients obviously follow all those rules and still can get colon cancer. I think the driving force is probably heritable risk that we can't quantify or don't understand that is the greatest cause of colon cancer.
Well, Dr. Vennick, we hear so much about in many disease states the ability to maybe transition from some of these tests like the colonoscopy or the at-home test. Is there any hope of a blood test marker at some point down the road, or is the research underway in that area?
The research is underway, and I think we're closing in on something that might actually be able to tell us who has polyps. I think we're close to that. Now, part of the problem is as appropriately, it's been studied mostly in older individuals like you and me. Well, at least like me.
That's okay. You can include me too.
And
all
and
of us. So,
right. And so looking in the population of, let's say, above 55 or 60 and identifying maybe circulating factors, circulating DNA for tumor DNA, for example, that might be a handle on finding people who have early cancer. Certainly, we're seeing that there are a number of diagnostic tests that are out there that are being used and not really by any means incredibly effective, but we are finding some early cases. The problem is going to be understanding if what we learn in 55 and 60-year-olds will apply to 35 and 40-year-olds, because we've been relatively successful in getting screening colonoscopy into patients above the age of 50. And the young patients, that's really where we need major strides. And I think a blood test would go a long way towards helping us figure out who we should be focusing our screening on. But we need to do the work to prove in the young populations. Diagnostic companies are doing that. There are probably a dozen different diagnostics companies working with amazing technology to look for genetics, cancer genes, et cetera. And I do think that we're closing in on something that'll be practical and useful down the road.
Are you talking about some gene editing CRISPR technology that might sort of be able to be applied here that, you know, as we move down the road with more understanding?
No, I'm thinking more about looking at a fingerprint let's say, a series of molecular features that may characterize an early cancer. And if you can find cells that have particular mutational patterns. I mean, it's like finding a needle in the haystack, but it's remarkable what the technology can do.
Is that also being fueled by some of the AI stuff that's in the background on looking at these large data sets and being able to call through them?
And I think the answer ultimately will be in AI, because my bet is we already know that we would know what some of these risks are, but we're not smart enough to figure it out. But I think to that end, I think the most important step we all need to take, and one of the things we're pushing for, is for there to be a single public database of all the information we gather on patients at risk or patients with cancer. And we're advocating for it. Obviously, the privacy and other issues, but I think that overall the benefit, and this is worldwide, because interestingly, the increased incidence in colon and rectal cancer in young people is not just in the U.S., it's everywhere. And so there's obviously a changing dynamic that is probably an explanation for if we had enough smarts to figure it out.
Well, we know there's a lot of work going on the microbiome. They all work on it because we've got federal government support, or we hope we do, because it plays such a large role in cancer research funding. I'm wondering, how do you see cancer funding and how well you think the dollars will be spent or are being spent?
Well, that's a moving target. I actually sit on a committee with the American Society of Clinical Oncology that spends a couple of days every 3 or 4 months on Capitol Hill. And of course, getting the folks on Capitol Hill interested in this, and good luck. I mean, there's not a lot of interest. We worry always about the cuts. To me, the greatest danger is that we're going to lose our young population, the young scientists who will continue on, from people like me when I move on, who's going to be carrying the baton. And the poor funding or inadequate funding going forward puts those individuals at risk for whether they can spend their careers doing what I've been able to do. Mm-hmm. I think that's my greatest fear. I do think we're on the cusp of big advances because, if nothing else, AI should give us the ability to figure out things that we've been unable to figure out so far. But we have to have folks still engaged to make those discoveries. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Vinook, thank you again so much for your important work and for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
That was Conversations on Healthcare, which features in-depth discussions on health policy and innovation with industry newsmakers from around the globe. You can hear their latest episode at any time with Alexa by saying, "Alexa, play the program Conversations on Healthcare." Next, the average age of farmers in the United States continues to rise, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's new Census of Ag. It's now nearly 60 years old. But there's also an increase in the number of new farmers, and student membership in the agricultural organization FFA is at an all-time high. Harvest Public Media contributor Peter Medlin reports on what these shifting populations say about the future of agriculture.
It's officially spring, and an unexpected snowstorm has hit the small village of Winnebago in northern Illinois. But the weather isn't stopping the line of tractors heading down a country road towards Winnebago High School. Today is the school's 49th annual Drive Your Tractor to School Day.
I'm a third generation. We always bring the biggest tractor that we have on the farm.
Maddie Palm-Graceffa is driving a giant 485-horsepower tractor that's typically tilling fields at her family's farm. For Maddie, like many Winnebago students, Tractor Day and farming are a family tradition. She's decided to pursue a career outside of agriculture, but other students, including junior Mason Heslop, see a future in farming.
I definitely like to be a farmer and like the rest, a lot of the family.
Student interest in agriculture is growing. The national group FFA, which used to be known as Future Farmers of America, announced a new record membership last year, almost 1 million students. And many states, like Illinois, have 100% affiliation, where every student taking an ag class can become a member. Christy Meyer is a communications manager for the national FFA organization. She says not all of their members want to be farmers. She says there are ag careers in everything from sales to drone technology, and the group isn't just for rural students either.
We're in 23 of the 25 largest cities. So we have a really successful chapter in Chicago. We have a newer chapter in Washington, D.C.
Some chapters grow food for their school, and others focus on local waterway quality. According to the latest USDA Ag Census, the number of new and beginning farmers is increasing. Yet, of the top 10 states with the highest percentage of new farmers, none are in the Midwest. Mark Schleusener has a few ideas why. He's with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service. For one, he says 75% of ag-dedicated land in the Midwest is covered by corn and soybeans. And it also has a bit to do with those big tractors the kids were driving to school.
Think of the value of your house. A mid-sized corn and soybean producer probably has several pieces of equipment, each of them valued at more than your house's value.
Those costs are a major barrier to entry for potential new farmers. Kate Coy is the senior beginning farmer associate at the Center for Rural Affairs. She develops ag curriculum and is a tenant farmer in Southwest Iowa.
You're seeing urban youth and rural youth who are interested. They might want there to be a path for them to be involved in agriculture, but we are up against enormous issues when it comes to accessing land.
In fact, finding affordable land is the top challenge for young farmers, according to the 2022 National Young Farmer Survey. The total number of farms continues to decline. That's due to consolidation, as the average farm size keeps increasing. And farmland across the Midwest is being sold for record highs. Last year in Missouri, a farm sold for close to $35,000 per acre. Coy says it's time to think outside of the traditional model of a family farm with just one farmer.
We could think of cooperative farms and collaborative farms. We could think of putting our land into a land trust and securing that land for generations so that it cannot be developed.
As farmers grow older, hundreds of millions of acres are expected to exchange hands over the next couple decades. And while there are many potential new farmers, the big question is whether they'll have the chance to tend the land. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Peter Medlin.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and the Great Plains, including Prairie Public. And we're going to talk now about April Fools.
Yay, I like that.
A tongue-in-cheek commentary here about making this a national
holiday. I like
holiday.
That, too.
And we'll have an April Fools edition of Bird Note. You hear the sounds of three birds, only one of which is real. See if you can tell.
I'm for making April Fool's Day a national holiday. I think we should take one day a year to commemorate all the foolishness we have to put up with the other 364. For example, why do we pay doctors whether or not they cure your illness? We pay real estate agents only if they achieve positive results. Why not pay physicians the same way? I'd at least like to see them offer money-back guarantees. If hardware stores can do it, so can hospitals. Another example is jogging every morning to keep fit while using cars, machines, electronic devices, power tools, remote controls, and subservient people the rest of the day to get as little exercise as possible. One more example is wearing ties and jackets when it's 75 degrees, then turning on the air conditioner to get comfortable. And how about getting 2 weeks summer vacation with 2 months of things we want to do while our kids get 2 months summer vacation with only 2 weeks of activities to keep them from getting bored to death? Or trying to conduct an intelligent conversation at a cocktail party? Or for that matter, eating and drinking while standing up, walking around, and trying to talk at all? The list of foolish things we do all year long goes on and on. And then there's also the list of fools we have to deal with. April Fool's Day as a national holiday would honor them, too. After all, to paraphrase Mark Twain, if it weren't for them, the rest of us could not succeed. This is Fred Flaxman.
This is Bird Note, with a special April Fool's Day quiz for you. Only one of the birds we're about to hear is real. See if you can tell which one, and let us know at birdnote.org for a chance to win a prize. Here is our first bird. The gray go-away bird of southern Africa is smoky gray with a tall, wispy crest. Favoring open woodlands and thorn savanna, gray go-away birds are known for their loud and nasal, "Wee-wee!" calls. often alerting other birds that there's a photographer nearby. Here is our second bird. The green treasure snatcher of Ecuador is a large ground-dwelling bird with a scaly head that almost resembles a box turtle. They're known for snatching jewelry and other shiny objects from travelers and hoarding it in deep burrows. And finally, bird number three. The zombie crossbill of Eastern Europe is often observed plucking the brains out of grasshopper heads. Omega-3s and other fatty acids found in brains help zombie crossbills fuel up for their long journeys south each winter. From Bird Note, happy April Fool's Day. I'm Nick Byard.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 6 is about Native contributions. It states, Native people continue to contribute to all levels of society, from local to global, in diverse fields including medicine, science, government, education, economics, art, music, and many more. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Dr. Twyla Baker, enrolled member of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, in part one of To Us, It Wasn't Discovered.
I come from a STEM background. Science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And there's this tendency to believe that those types of things did not exist prior to, you know, colonization. And of course they existed here. I mean, we had our medicines, we had our technology, we had our architecture, we built earth lodges with no nails. You know, we were inventors, we were artists, musicians, we were all of these things. And I think about the Native contributions, and it's not just like in recent memory or anything like that, but all of these medicines, all of these innovations with the natural world, democracy, all of this, you know, thought, all of this stuff was contributed by Native people, and we didn't necessarily get the acknowledgement, not necessarily, we did not get the acknowledgement that would have been given to a non-Native person. Like, I tend to think of like these places that got named, like the Mount McKinley or whatever, they all had names before. They had identifiers before. They were already named. We had a name for them. The fact that somebody comes and discovers a particular mountain or something and then puts his name on it does not make that all of a sudden there's a mountain there. You know, these things have been recognized and acknowledged for generations. So I think about all of that and how there's kind of a resurgence of and a reclamation of that, those identities.
I'm Sharla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
Support is provided by Drs. Kirk Coyer and Phil Sondrel of Urgent Med, providing personalized walk-in medical care for all ages 7 days a week in South Fargo. Urgent Med, where urgent care doesn't feel like urgent care.
And that's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up at 8 o'clock Central, it's Hidden Brain with Shankar Vedantam as the show explores the topic, what smartphones are doing to our kids.
So much we still need to learn about that topic. I'll look forward to listening to that. Actually, coming up tomorrow on Main Street, imagine raising a child with dyslexia. It's like tending a garden of wildflowers. It requires patience, understanding, and the belief that with the right support, every unique mind can bloom into something extraordinary. But what if that support is not available? We'll spotlight the inspiring story of Carrie Buckles. She left her career to learn about dyslexia and provide a better life for her son, Haley, who's now a college graduate with a master's degree. She founded Haley's Hope, which provides services to students and adults in this three-state area who suffer from dyslexia. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.